So the subject this morning is which eligible people may not marry each other. Which eligible people may not marry each other. In other words, which people, though eligible to marry, may not marry one another. Even among those who are eligible to marry, who are unmarried and may marry, and even where there may be spiritual harmony in the Lord, there are limitations. First of all, then, near relations may not marry each other. Near relations may not marry each other. Marriage ought not to be within the degrees of consanguinity or affinity forbidden in the world. The main passage given is Leviticus 18, but with limited time we'll only read part of it. Leviticus 18, verse 6. None of you shall approach to any that is near of kin to him to uncover their nakedness. I am the Lord. The nakedness of thy father or the nakedness of thy mother shalt thou not uncover. She is thy mother. Thou shalt not uncover her nakedness. The nakedness of thy father's wife shalt thou not uncover. It is thy father's nakedness. The nakedness of thy sister, the daughter of thy father, or daughter of thy mother, whether she be born at home or born abroad, even their nakedness thou shalt not uncover. The nakedness of thy son's daughter, or of thy daughter's daughter, even their nakedness thou shalt not uncover. For theirs is thine own nakedness. The nakedness of thy father's wife's daughter, begotten of thy father, she is thy sister, thou shalt not uncover her nakedness. Thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy father's sister, she is thy father's near kinswoman. Thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy mother's sister, for she is thy mother's near kinswoman. Thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy father's brother, thou shalt not approach to his wife, she is thine aunt. Thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy daughter-in-law, she is thy son's wife, thou shalt not uncover her nakedness. Thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy brother's wife, it is thy brother's nakedness. Thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of a woman and her daughter, neither shalt thou take her son's daughter or her daughter's daughter, to uncover her nakedness, for they are her near kinswomen. It is wickedness. Neither shalt thou take a wife to her sister, to vex her to uncover her nakedness beside the other in her lifetime. Verse 18, by the way, doesn't cancel out what is stated elsewhere, that a man is not to marry his sister-in-law. It's referring to, I suppose, an evasion of that, that a man could marry two sisters at one and the same time, but this is forbidden. The other verse given is 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 1. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 1. It is reported commonly that there is fornication among you, and such fornication as is not so much as named among the Gentiles, that one should have his father's wife. We are not told here whether the father was still living, but evidently the form of immorality was greatly exacerbated by the fact that it was a man's stepmother. And then finally, Amos chapter 2 and verse 7. Amos chapter 2 and verse 7. That turned after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor and turn aside the way of the meek, and a man and his father will go in unto the same maid to profane my holy name. Whatever other factors were involved in the immorality envisaged in Amos 2 verse 7, it is obviously exacerbated by the thought of a father and son having intercourse with the same woman. So clearly the immorality, even if it may have been immorality anyway, but the fact that father and son, well, it was obviously two men, it was the same woman, but the fact that they were father and son exacerbated the evil concern. So these limitations in Leviticus 18 are to be viewed as standing limitations on marriage of those near of kin. Now perhaps the objection that arises in our minds is simply this. Adam and Eve's children clearly intermarried. We all know the old chestnut about Cain's wife, which recurs regularly. And it is quite obvious that the first generation after Adam and Eve did intermarry brother and sister. How are we to answer this? Well, the answer is as follows, if we can just make a series of points. First of all, the moral principle is that God has the right to regulate all human relations. Secondly, marriage between one man and one woman is the created order in the present world. Thirdly, prior to the increase of mankind, God appointed marriage, even of brother and sister. But then fourthly, subsequent to the increase of mankind, he sovereignly prohibited such marriages between brother and sister, and indeed other close relationships. Fifthly, the fact that in the circumstances of the beginning of mankind he allowed it does not make the subsequent prohibition temporary. Because, sixthly, the circumstances of Adam's immediate children no more exist now than they did in the time of Moses and the time when these prohibitions were given. So that God has the right to regulate marriage. Marriage is defined as between one man and one woman. Subsequent to the increase of mankind, God, in his absolute authority, set limitations on the degree of close kinship where marriage can take place. And so a man may not marry his sister, or his aunt, or his niece, and a woman may not marry her brother, her uncle, her nephew. Secondly, man cannot legitimize what God has not. Man cannot legitimize what God has not. The confession goes on to say, nor can such incestuous marriages ever be made lawful by any law of man or consent of parties, so as those persons may live together as man and wife. The limitations, the prohibitions of incestuous marriage still stand, and as far as I'm aware, still enforce even in this country. But for how long one can, or at least to some extent they're still in force, but for how long is a question, because what is contained in this part of the confession is the exact opposite of the modern view. It says, nor can such incestuous marriages ever be made lawful by any law of man or consent of parties, so as those persons may live together as man and wife. The modern approach is atheistic, and God, if he is acknowledged as existing, is not considered the legislator for man. And so the modern outlook is that consenting adults may do as they please, and provided no one is being forced to do anything, and no one seems to be getting hurt, as if you had the ability to know that, then it doesn't matter. But the confession is stating the exact opposite, namely that God's law stands irrespective of the consent of the parties or the legalizing of those in authority. God's law stands. Mark chapter 6 and verse 18. Mark 6:18. Reading from verse 17. For Herod himself had sent forth and laid hold upon John and bound him in prison for Herodias' sake, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. But John had said unto Herod, It is not lawful for thee to have thy brother's wife. It remained wrong, and the fact that Herod had so much civil power in his hands couldn't make it right. He couldn't countermand the authority of God himself. Leviticus 18 and verse 24, Defile not ye yourselves in any of these things, for in all these the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you. And the land is defiled, therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it, and the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants. Ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, neither any of your own nation, nor any stranger that sojourneth among you. For all these abominations of the men of the land done, which were before you, and the land is defiled, and the land spew not you, that the land spew not you out also, when ye defile it, as it spewed out the nations that were before you. The point here is that God declares his judgment against these things, and his condemnation is unavoidable and fixed. Thirdly, the marriage bond puts the husband or wife's family in the same position as their own. The marriage bond puts the husband or wife's family in the same position as their own. The confession goes on to say, the man may not marry any of his wife's kindred nearer in blood than he may of his own, nor the woman of her husband's kindred nearer in blood than of her own. Leviticus 20 and verse 19 to 21. Leviticus 20 verse 19. And thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy mother's sister, nor of thy father's sister, for he uncovereth his near kin. They shall bear their iniquity. And if a man shall lie with his uncle's wife, he hath uncovered his uncle's nakedness, they shall bear their sin, they shall die childless. And if a man shall take his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing. He hath uncovered his brother's nakedness, they shall be childless. If you compare verse 19, where it says, For he uncovereth his near kin, if you go back to chapter 18 and verse 6, none of you shall approach to any that is near of kin to him to uncover their nakedness. I am the Lord. You'll see that the similarity of expression indicates the point that the confession is making, that the marriage bond means that the marriage partner's family come within the same bounds of affinity as his own family connection. And so if a man's wife dies, or a woman's husband dies, he or she may not marry the dead marriage partner's relations that are within the same boundaries as the prohibition applies to his own family. So that if a man may not marry his sister, neither may he marry his dead wife's sister. Likewise, a woman, her brother-in-law, a man may not marry his aunt, he may not marry his dead wife's aunt, and so on. So that means then that a man's wife's aunt, niece, or sister are not possibilities if a man is bereaved of his wife, and likewise the woman bereaved of her husband in reverse. So this does mean that a man may not marry his deceased wife's sister, nor may a woman marry her deceased husband's brother. This has been hotly disputed, but nevertheless we believe that to be the scriptural position. The reason, I suppose, it's much more likely to occur in the one generation, the aunt or the niece is less likely, but the problem arises more often in someone, a man wanting to marry his dead wife's sister, or a woman wanting to marry her dead husband's brother. But this is prohibited in the Word of God. The very terms we use, if your wife has a sister, you call her a sister-in-law, or a brother-in-law, or mother-in-law, and so on. These terms actually correctly indicate the legitimate kind of affection between such. A man's affection for his sister-in-law should be of a very different kind to that he has to his wife. His affection for his sister-in-law should be like that of a brother towards his sister, and so on. Now, the objection may be raised, but what about what is known as the Levirate law? Apparently the Latin word levir means husband's brother, and so the arrangement given in Deuteronomy 25 is sometimes called the Levirate law. Deuteronomy 25 and verse 5 to verse 10. Deuteronomy 25 and verse 5. If brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife, and perform the duty of an husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate unto the elders, and say, my husband's brother refuseth to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak unto him. And if he stand to it and say, I like not to take her, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders, and loose his shoe from off his foot, and spit in his face, and shall answer and say, so shall it be done unto that man that will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him that hath his shoe loosed. So here it is expected, though not absolutely required, that the dead brother, if there are no children to the marriage, the dead man's brother will take his widow and raise up a seed to his brother's name. And it is sometimes argued, well, there you are, doesn't that show that it must be legitimate for a man to marry his dead brother's wife? But this exception proves the rule. It is precisely because the brother is next of kin to the dead man that the firstborn is to be treated as the heir of the dead man. And it was, of course, dependent upon the Old Testament church, Israel, its unique position in the land, and the inheritance of the land, and the name of the dead man not being blotted out from the inheritance of the Lord. But this does not alter the standing rule, but confirms it. The very fact that this exception, the purpose of this exception, indicates that ordinarily such next of kin should not marry. But then the objection might be, how can the prohibition be moral when there is a God-given exception? How can it be absolutely wrong for a man to marry his dead brother's wife if it is absolutely wrong? And the same exception, the same argument, of course, applies to a man marrying his sister. How can it be that it was legitimate for Adam's immediate children to marry among themselves if it is absolutely wrong? Well, the answer is this. There can be moral commands with positive additions. There can be moral commands with positive additions. Let me explain. By moral, we mean things that apply in all times and places in this world. And by positive, we mean things that are not automatically wrong, except God, by positive, distinct revelation, has declared them to be so. Take, for example, the Sabbath. The weekly Sabbath was ordained at creation. It was appointed by God and exemplified by God's making all things in 6 days and resting the seventh day. So the principle of God governing our time is always applicable. And in this world, one day in seven is always to be kept as a Sabbath to the Lord. But the particular day is subject to change. The particular day is positive. It's the weekly Sabbath is moral, but the particular day is positive. From creation to the death of Christ, it was the seventh day. From the resurrection of Christ to the end of the world, it is the first day. So likewise, marriage, God's right to govern all human relationships, is that stands always. In this world, marriage is to be between one man and one woman. That is universally and always applicable. But God set certain limits in the outworking of that. He permitted marriage of brother and sister in the first generation after Adam and Eve. He then limited and prohibited certain close of marriage within a certain degrees of blood relationship, though he reserved the right to make the exception in the case of the temporary Levirate law. But those laws given in Leviticus prohibiting marriage within certain degrees of affinity, or within certain degrees of the of affinity of a dead married partner, those laws, unlike the particular day of the Sabbath, have not been changed, and therefore they stand. It all comes right back to the authority of God. God governs. God has the right to declare his mind concerning all human relationships. In this present world, he has ordained marriage, not between two people of the same gender, but between one man and one woman. That is applicable in all places and times. He has added to that, subsequent to the second generation of man, limitations of affinity. He has never repealed those precepts, those limitations, and therefore they must be taken as standard. And so our confession of faith correctly says that these limitations of who may have married who still stand. These things are not easy and not always easily understood, but the Word of God is sufficient to guide us and to direct us even in these difficult and vexatious things. And one thing is sure, we can never be losers by heeding the Word of God.